gratitude for this congregation's continued support for the work that we do at UU Faith Action in this public policy and social justice ministry. Literally, without the support of congregations like you, I wouldn't be able to stand here and tell stories like I will soon. Just like the other 21 congregations, the other 20 congregations here in the Garden State, all of which are also affiliate members, your congregation supports our statewide ministry with a yearly per member pledge, and at least it's as important, your willingness, its members' willingness, to participate in our campaigns. Together, we've worked on everything from combating climate change, and I know you're having a forum about that this afternoon, to supporting reproductive health clinic workers here in New Jersey to do their jobs safely and ensure that women and their partners have real choices, to working for marriage equality, one of our great wins in this state, and working against the worst excesses of the never-ending campaign against immigrants that comes from on high. For our part, the board, staff, and 54 statewide volunteers of Faith Action support you back. We provide effective and principled tools for social change, including our nearly weekly action alert emails that allow you to shoot an email off to your local legislator about, say, your support for increasing the minimum wage, which just got passed. We write a sample email letter that's addressed to legislators, and we send it to you, of course, because you're UUs. It has to be customizable because you'll want to fuss with it, maybe. But if you're busy and you don't want to fuss with anything, you just want to get the darn thing off your email list, you can do that too. When you're done, all you do is type in your zip code, up pops your state senator and assembly people, and it sends it directly to them. You also provide resources to get me to Trenton, where I am, in effect, your UU lobbyist. I go in looking like this. I say it's my best Mormon missionary look I can pull off. With my little lapel pin. They love lapel pins in Trenton. Everyone has a lapel pin. This actually, by the way, is a British Unitarian chalice, but so far no legislator has called me out on that. But it's important to have a place at the table. It actually is important, the reason why all these companies and interest groups pay high-level lobbyists to have lunches, I don't get to do that, by the way, but I do get to go down to Trenton, is that when they see faces over and over again, and they come to know what you're about, and even maybe trust you a little bit, or at least listen to you, you have a place at the table. And because you have helped me be there, we have a place at the table. And that's an important part of the work. Before I get into this morning's sermon topic, I also need to mention that, unfortunately, I won't be able to stay after the service. Usually I come and I do a full meal deal. I do something, I talk to the dialogue program before, and then I like to stay in case you have questions, and certainly if you'd like to become involved. But today, this afternoon at 2:45, one of the things we do is host events for UUs. We bring in outside speakers, and we're really pleased to host a journalist, WNYC NPR journalist Matt Katz. Some of you may have heard on air. He's going to be speaking to us about the current state of immigration and what's happening in New Jersey and around the country. In order to make it in time just to that event, I'm going to have to dine and dash. But luckily for me and for you, we have three terrific congregational liaisons that were mentioned earlier. Dave Reskoff, I saw you, Dave. Do you want to raise your hand? And the husband-wife duo, Ann and Joe Kuhl. I know Joe couldn't be here today, but Ann, do you want to raise your hand? For those of you who don't know, they are experts on UU Faith Action. They know everything. Just nod, like you know what I'm talking about. They'd be very happy to put you in touch. And, of course, you can get those email action alerts. And, you know, this is my pitch. I make it everywhere I go, but it's very important. And I'm just going to go aside from my script for a second. Every time I meet with legislators, I just met last week with Senator Cruz Perez from Camden with a group of coalition partners arguing that we need more money in the state budget to increase the pilot project that will allow all indigent detainees in the Elizabeth and Essex and Bergen and Hudson County jails to have legal representation. Because right now, because they're not citizens, they have no legal representation. And we know that with legal representation, not only are their cases 30% more of the time for asylum because there's such a vast sweep of everyone under this current regime. But also, they don't have to spend their life savings, which too many of them are doing, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 wiped out of very small bank accounts or gathered from friends and family so they can pay a lawyer who says, I can get you out. We'll get you out of detention. We'll keep you here, only to say, this happens very often, oh, sorry, no, we can't do anything for you. If we give them the equivalent of legal aid, those people can be honest. They're not there to make a buck and say, your case isn't winnable, let's talk about next steps. And they can not put their family even deeper into poverty. That's a massive plus. So do those, that's all to say. She said when we were meeting with the legislator, your letters matter on this issue. Driver's licenses, we were talking about universal representation. Get your people to email Governor Murphy. It's right now, it's sitting in his lap. He's equivocating a bit, despite having said he would do this. Because it's budget, and it's going to be a very, very rough budget fight this year from everything we're told. And yet this will save lives. This will literally save lives and families in New Jersey, and so we're pushing very hard. So please do sign up for our email campaign. Even if you ignore 80% of them, if you can do 20%, that's something. All right, I'm back on script. We have to talk dirt. Ever since I was a little kid, I can remember my parents, but especially my mother, talking about things showing dirt. Does this ring any bells for anyone else? Well, we're certainly not going to buy you those white pants, shorts, shirt, gloves, hat. It will just show the dirt. Or I remember when they were shopping for new carpeting, we moved when I was about 7 for the living room and counters for the kitchen, or even the seat covers in the family car. They always had to be some version of speckly brown that wouldn't, right, show the dirt. It was a mania, which, as I thought more about it, might have stemmed from buying a purple four-door Datsun. Are there any millennials? That was what Nissan was called before it was Nissan. That had white vinyl interiors. Somehow they had lost their marbles and bought this white vinyl interior. And of course, it wasn't the interiors. It was my 4-year-old brother and the permanent black pen in his car seat on the back of the passenger side. Maybe that led to their obsession with nothing ever being able to show the dirt. Of course, there's an interesting analogy lurking just below the surface of this small piece of Gregson family history. It's an analogy, if you will, about how white America has, ever since the emancipation of slaves, dealt with law enforcement and race. In a nutshell, it boils down to this, as I tried in my way to explain to children without freaking them out about the police. I have 2 kids of my own. Racial bias is a sad reality in law enforcement, just the same as it is in the rest of American culture. And for many white folks, this sort of makes it worse, right? For many white folks, if we don't see that, we don't smell it, we don't touch it, we don't experience it, then it must not exist, right? My experience growing up in a nice white suburb of Seattle, Washington, we never really saw the police. I think maybe my mom, she was a crazy driver, maybe she got pulled over once or something. But we had no family stories, for example, of someone being pulled over randomly, or being searched, or being told to get out of the car. Absolutely none. My experience was like, well, I guess the police are there for us. That is absolutely not the experience of far too many people of color in this country. And if you've been watching the news at all for the last, 20 years, you might have picked up on that too. Just like running your hand over the gray, black, and brown surface of my composite rock countertops in my kitchen, my parents would be very, very proud. Just because you can't see the crumbs doesn't mean they're not there. Even as a self-proclaimed progressive, I have to admit to you that I didn't honestly pay that much attention to racialized policing. or the issue of police brutality against Americans of color. The one thing I can really remember, of course, was the Rodney King riots. Back in 1991, and of course that's probably why that New York Times op-ed that Steve read for us, why that's so striking, is because they've worked so hard after this national disaster to try to bring some semblance of rationality and humaneness back to those that city and those communities. But I also have to say that it began to fade for me. Back in 1991, I was just graduated from college. I was a white guy. I had other things on my mind. It seemed something far away, almost movie-like in its portrayal, and thus a little less real. If you've never experienced it before, right, it can feel like it has more in common with a movie than real life. For me, things began to shift, if slowly, and I credit this religious faith for helping me get there. Because I was studying for the ministry, and we were starting to have open conversations in like many denominations in this country that are split between white and black or white and brown. In this historically white denomination, we were starting to hear renewed calls for something we'd always sort of believed in, or we thought we believed in anyway, a renewed call for white UUs in particular to examine not just individual racism like Northam's pictures, as bad as those are. You know, they individualize, well, I'm not a Klan member, I've never posed in blackface, so certainly I don't have real issues with racism. But systemic racism, that kind of just in the background, stuff you don't even know that you believe, that I certainly grew up with, both within UUism and, of course, within American culture. And then in the summer of 2014, something else happened for me, maybe for some of you. Michael Brown was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis, with a long history of racialized police malpractice. Something like 60% African-American community, and it had, I want to say, 120 police officers, 4 were black. More rioting, and the sense that, in fact, not much had changed since Watts. But how could that be? How could it be like this? Again, it was, right, 2014. Hadn't we changed? We had Obama, right, all that. And then in the summer of 2016, I got this job. I'd come back from 5 years in the UK working with the British Unitarians. I got this job in, I guess, July 1st, and all hell seemed to break loose. And it broke loose across the country. July 5th, Alton Sterling, a 37-year-old black man, shot to death at close range while on the ground by 2 white Baton Rouge police officers, and his death was captured, like in that picture. And this is really what shifted the conversation, on a smartphone video. A day later, July 6th, Philando Castile, that 32-year-old man, black man, driving in his car with his girlfriend and 4-year-old stepdaughter, girlfriend's daughter in the back seat, during a routine traffic stop. I read the transcript again to remember what had happened, and she was filming while this was all going down right next, and he said, I have a license for a gun, and the cop said, don't get it. And he said, oh, I was just going to, and he said, don't get the gun. And he said, I'm not getting it. His hands were still like this. And the girlfriend said, he's not, and the officer shot him multiple times while standing outside. July 7th, a day later, during a protest of those 2 killings, Michael Xavier Johnson ambushed and killed 5 Dallas police officers. 9 other officers were injured. It was a retaliatory ambush. And then July 27th, as we were all still reeling from this, Baltimore's top prosecutor dropped all charges against officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man who died after riding in a police wagon in custody. 6 officers faced charges, and this happens over, you want to know about African-American rage, this is really, in some ways, what it's about. 6 officers faced charges, but a trial for one officer ended in a hung jury, and three others were acquitted after a trial by a judge. So not only does the trauma happen, but then there's additional trauma because then justice, again and again, maybe not in every single one of these cases, but again and again, justice doesn't happen. It was at this juncture that I knew I had to do something. Some of you may have heeded a call. We put a call out to youths across the state to come to Summit, a statewide gathering, to figure out what youths had to do to combat. This is life or death. This isn't, you know, a long legislative campaign. This was a sense that something is so deeply wrong in our country. What can us white folks and others finally begin to see and feel and experience to pass our hands across that surface that to us looks fine, but when you get down and you look at it in the light, you see it's a mess. That complex, highly dangerous interaction between law enforcement and minority communities, and especially African-American communities, that too often leaves black citizens traumatized, even killed, and that also, let's not forget, takes its toll on police as well. Because for everyone who does this horrible act, there are lots who are trying, who are stumbling, maybe don't have all the lingo right on, but they're trying, and their lives and their jobs have just gotten more difficult as well. Out of that effort, I'm really pleased to be able to say that something good has come. We created, it went from a UU group to an interfaith group, because we realized if we're really going to make a difference, it can't just be the small UUs. We're going to have to partner with others. So we have Muslims, Jews of different denominations, Christians, and UUs coming together. And we created, over 2 years, a toolkit. And it's a multi-faith congregational toolkit designed to be dropped, maybe with a trainer, into a congregation like this one. And like the Welcoming Congregation Handbook, for those of you who know what I'm talking about, that was to help us really welcome LGBTQ people. This is designed for UUs and others to take a strong anti-racist lens and organize within the community to then interact with local police. And the argument is, we're going in with an anti-racist agenda. We'll be upfront about that. And yet, this is also an agenda that we think will save police lives as well in the long run and will bring us all closer together. But we have to do this hard work. And congregations are uniquely situated to talk to police, local police. We have standing. We are rooted in community. We often have conversations with police. Sometimes we have police in our own congregations, of course, are those who love police or care for them. And we're seen as a traditional force, right? They don't know you maybe as well, but we're kind of traditional. I look traditional. This is a way of moving the conversation forward and really trying to make local change. We're going to begin piling that in 2 to 4 congregations, UU and non-UU, over the next several months. And I hope someday maybe it'll become available if folks here would like to use it and see what difference you can make here. What I'm here to talk about today, though, is a bombshell that went off. Thank God not about a racialized shooting incident, although those have also happened in New Jersey, but a specific, not one particular incident, but instead a compendium of incidents. How many of you have heard of a report that NJ.com, which is a part of, I think, the Star Ledger, the parent company, a report put out called The Force? Has that run across anyone's? A couple. I don't think it's gotten out there, which is one reason I wanted to bring it to your attention. It's the first of its kind in the country, according to its authors, and basically what it is, an interactive database focused on New Jersey that compiles from 5 years, 2011 to 16, use of force, actual use of force data that police have been required to report every time they have a use of force incident in their town. And it's broken down not only by town, so you can go online, you can look this up, it's free, theforce.org or something like that, and you can put in your town, and it will actually break it down by individual officer. So you can find out, and if you think about it for a second, that's what's so powerful. Because they've done the screening of the stats. The database records, 20 years ago, state officials began making this requirement on the municipal level. They said, all right, we need you to start filling out more paperwork. I'm sure that was a joy. Envisioning that someday they would put it together on a state level so there would be a way to track use of force. And there are many good things that would come out of that tracking, right? You could figure out those police forces that seem to be minimizing violence or those that are in trouble, maybe, that need more help. You can also flag bad actors, right? That rotten apple that people like to talk about. Or bad policies, because sometimes this is endemic in a community. Police force is a little rotten. Instead, what they got was tens of thousands of paper records, which until this force report literally gathered dust in various parts of the state, was never used. Now, what did the researchers find? Well, what you might expect. They found a range of behaviors by police across a range of jurisdictions. And they were very clear. I thought they did this. They were very clever. In the front page, they make it very clear at the top, force is authorized, right? This is not wrong to have use of force. Sometimes it's necessary. You can think of all kinds of reasons why it would be necessary. Yet they also found, this report finds some very troubling outliers that had never been compiled and put together before. Police officers and police departments that were way over the average in their use of force, and worst of all, were never flagged, rarely disciplined, and therefore never learned from. There's never been a statewide effort to make this better in New Jersey. The force report makes for really fascinating reading. I know that sort of doesn't sound right, but it's fascinating. It allows you, again, to search by town, and there are some real surprises. Can you guess where the most egregious use of force is? Of course, this is per capita. This is a percentage of use of force given the population of a given town, because, you know, to compare Camden and Holmdel wouldn't be fair otherwise. Anyone know? This made statewide news. The worst use of force record in the state of New Jersey. Nope. Asbury Park, Seaside. Nope. Ever heard of a town called Maplewood, New Jersey? I live right next door to it in South Orange. And we pride ourselves on being a racially inclusive, we call ourselves Brooklyn in New Jersey. It came as much as a shock for the progressive-leaning residents of Maplewood that it is listed as number one in the excessive use of force, meaning that its officers used force at a higher rate than all 467 other municipalities in New Jersey per capita over 5 years of the study. The lowest use of force, I thought you might like to know, Montgomery in Somerset County. One use of force over those 5 years, 1.33 incidents per 1,000 arrests. So you can see that discrepancy. I think in Maplewood it was something like 110 uses of force per 1,000. 10% of all of their arrests had some use of force. And it's not, you know, like a slap on the butt. They describe what the use of force is. Now here's the other kicker. Based on population, a black person in New Jersey is 224% more likely to have force used on them than a white person. They were more than twice as likely to be shot, more likely to be pepper sprayed, and more likely to be injured or hospitalized by police. As the report notes, no matter how you parse it, the use of force by police in New Jersey is not equal. Some interesting anomalies occur as well. I wanted to be able to tell you, what does Lincroft, it turns out you're unincorporated, so you don't have your own police department, so you don't pop up, but you do fall under Middletown's jurisdiction, I believe. One of the nearest towns to this church, Holmdel, you'll be pleased to know, has a below average percentage, just 16.2%. Any of you live in Holmdel? Is that a draw? Oh. Yet just next door here in Middletown, the use of force ratchets up significantly, 49.7% force rate, with 381 total uses of force. The average rate, again, in the state is 30.5. So Middletown actually, and they have a useful pie graph that shows if Middletown was LA, New York, Chicago, where they have huge reporting requirements, and if you get to a certain percentage as a police officer, you have to come in and it's analyzed and you have to describe what happened. Middletown would have, I think something like 70% of its police officers would have had that intervention if they were in LA, Chicago, or New York. We don't have any of that standardized in New Jersey. So the question, of course, is what do we do with that information? If you exercise common sense, just as with a dirty countertop, you really have two choices. You could ignore the countertop because it looks, from where you're standing, it looks kind of clean. Just don't put your hand down. Or you can see the dirt and you can clean it up. That's it, really. I'm really pleased to say that the independent prosecutor bill just got passed. Activists have been working on this for years in New Jersey, and it's been blocked. And what that means is anytime someone is killed in an interaction with police, it doesn't go to the county prosecutor, who, by the way, has a very, very close relationship with all their local police. It has to go to the state attorney general's office so that there is just at least the appearance of a lack of bias. That's a very, that could be a life-saving move because it sends a message of accountability. So we're really pleased. We worked hard. Many of you, did any of you send a letter to Murphy? Because he was sort of holding off on that. I saw a couple hands. See, that's why you need to get on my email list, because then you could rejoice with me that we got that passed. We can continue to educate, email, and lobby through our Criminal Justice Task Force on racial justice. I know that you've done a lot of work on racial justice in this congregation, for which you should be applauded. And I also know that you're probably wondering, what do we do next? This kind of work, something on local policing, could be life-saving. You just need some tools, and I hopefully will be getting some extra tools for you. You may already be in conversations with local police around this. Finally, we can look at how dirty our common house has grown over the years. We have a dirty house. It's kind of filthy in parts. But we shouldn't be afraid to face it. And that is really the central message of Unitarian Universalism. If you came today and you really had no interest, like your life is hard, and you didn't really want to hear about racial justice or policing, you just wanted a little happy note or a little lift, this is your moment, right? We are telling each other, don't be afraid, right? We're in this together. You may not be able to lift right now, but we'll help you along, and you'll be able to lift soon enough. But we still are guarding each other. Did you see that lineup of kids? We want them to grow up in a different kind of place than I grew up in. And we can do that. We've done that before. We're doing it right now. The independent prosecutor bill is evidence that will make a difference. I promise you that. I want to end with these words from Professor Brittany Cooper in an essay she wrote called One of 11 Major Misconceptions About the Black Lives Matter Movement. Professor Cooper is Associate Professor of Women and Gender Studies and Africana Studies here in Rutgers. She's got a great TED Talk. I recommend you look her up, Brittany Cooper. She co-founded the popular Crunk Feminist Collective blog. Number 9 on this list of 11 misconceptions. Number 9 is the movement hates police officers. Police officers are people, she writes. Their lives have inherent value. Does this echo UU principles at all? This movement is not an anti-people movement, therefore it is not an anti-police officer movement. Most police officers are just everyday people like you and me who want to do their jobs, make a living for their families, and get home safely every night. This does not mean, however, that police are not implicated in a system that criminalizes black people just because they're black. The Black Lives Matter movement is not trying to make the world more unsafe for police officers. It hopes to make police officers less of a threat to communities of color. Increasingly, the presence of police makes black people feel less rather than more safe. And that has everything to do with the antagonistic and power-laden ways in which police interact with citizens more generally and black citizens in particular. Therefore, police officers must rebuild trust with the communities they serve, not the other way around. And I would add, in this moment of worship, we UUs must also rebuild trust as co-guardians of the communities we live in, responsible for our children and ourselves, also for our police, also for our brothers and sisters of color. We may need to make a major change in how we think about force, and it's time, and I think religious groups can be leaders on this. I hope you'll join me in this important work to save lives here in New Jersey and Monmouth County. Amen. Oh, I did. You're right. Well, do you want to? We skipped some music. I'm so sorry. I was so excited to talk about my social justice. Do we have time?
Do you have time?
I may have to run out, but I will. I'll sit and listen to your music for a little bit.
Blood will flow when flesh and steel are one, drying in the color of the evening sun. Tomorrow's red.